Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. Okay, so I brought the Sanyutta Nikaya. Okay, so this is one of the biggest, thickest books in the early Buddhist texts. Chapter 48 is where we find the faculties. Okay. And I'm going to read a few suttas, brief suttas. Okay, so here is one on how it can lead to nibbana by developing the five indriyas. Okay, this is Samyutta Nikaya 48.17. Bhikkhus, there are these five faculties. What five? The faculty of faith, the faculty of energy, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. These are the five faculties. One who has completed and fulfilled these five faculties is an arahant. If they are weaker than that, one is an attainer of nibbana in the interval. If still weaker, an attainer of nibbana upon landing. If still weaker, an attainer of nibbana without exertion. If still weaker, an attainer of nibbana with exertion. If still weaker, one who is bound upstream and heading towards the akhanita realm. If still weaker, a once returner. If still weaker, a stream enterer. If still weaker, a Dhamma follower. If still weaker, a faith follower. Okay, so that was a...
It sounds like Bandara Baba. It's a vote.
I don't have the Pali handy. But I could try to look that up. But anyway, it is a list of attainments from Arahant on down. Okay, and there's sort of several lesser notches. We would all recognize probably once returner, stream enterer, you know. Anyway, I point this out because I remember being told when I was a junior monk from some senior monks, they said, everyone who attains nibbana does so. This was just kind of monks talking to each other. This wasn't any sutta or anything. They were just talking when the lay people weren't around. Whenever somebody attains nibbana, it's always because they came to understand it was either dependent origination or the five khandhas. It's because they penetrated those that they attained nibbana. But here's a sutta saying, oh, no, you can do it with the five indriyas. So I find that interesting. And then there's this series of suttas which basically say, actually, you don't even need all five. There's a sutta saying, even if you've got those last four perfected, you could attain Nibbana. Then there's another sutta, even if you attain just those last three of them, you could attain Nibbana. Let me read the one about the last three. It involves this one arhant named Pindola Bharadvaja. Okay, so this sutta is called Pindola, Samyutta Nikaya 48.49. Thus I have heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in Gositas Park. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Pindola Bharadvaja had declared final knowledge thus, I understand, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. Then a number of bhikkhus approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Pindola Bharadvaja has declared final knowledge thus. I understand, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. Considering what reason has the Venerable Pindola Bharadvaja declared final knowledge thus. Then the Buddha says, It is, bhikkhus, because he has developed and cultivated three faculties that the bhikkhu Pindola Bharadvaja has declared final knowledge thus. What are those three? The faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. That's just the last three out of five. It is because he has developed and cultivated these three faculties that the Bhikkhu Pindola Bharadvaja has declared final knowledge thus. In what, bhikkhus, do these three faculties end? They end in destruction. End in the destruction of what? Of birth, aging, and death. Considering that they end in the destruction of birth, aging, and death, the Bhikkhu Pindola Bharadvaja has declared final knowledge thus. I understand. Destroyed his birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. This Arhant Pindola Bharadvaja, he's kind of or they just call him Pindola, okay? So Bharadvaja is kind of his family name, like his clan name. There's several Bharadvajas, not just him. He's quite the character, and I really like him. He's one of my favorite arhants. There was a famous sutta where, he had psychic powers. He's one of the arhants with psychic powers, and there was a layman who had a clever idea he wanted to see which arhants might have some psychic powers. So he made this contest, and he had like this wooden pole, a tall wooden pole, and he put a valuable bowl on the top of the pole. And he said, if any of you sadhus, any of you monks can just fly on up in the sky and take the bowl, you can have it. So then Pindola, who could do that, he floated up in the air and took the bowl. And then And then the Buddha later on gave Pindola kind of this scolding, saying, that was not smart. It is as though you were offered a wooden nickel. You know, it's just like a woman who shows her panties to a man for just a wooden nickel. You know, you shouldn't have shown that. You shouldn't have shown that. You know, it cheapens it. It kind of... You know? Yeah. So Pindola kind of got in trouble there. And there's this other sutta where he gets in pretty big trouble too, where he met this young girl who came from a very poor family. And he decided to... he also had this psychic power. He could manifest objects out of nowhere. You could just cause things to pop into existence. So he manifested a tiara. It's like a crown of jewels for this little girl to wear on her head. And then the king of the land saw this little girl with the tiara, wearing this tiara, and he knew that this was a very poor girl. And there's no way a little poor girl like could have that without some thief stealing it. Surely a thief stole this tiara. So then the king had that girl's father arrested and thrown into prison. And then, so then word of this got back to the Buddha, and, you know, he kind of figured out what happened, and the Buddha had to go sort this out. He went to the king and said, you know, actually, that man didn't steal the tiara. It was one of my monks. He manifested the tiara with his psychic powers, and so then they got the man released from prison, but it was a big mess. So then the Buddha said to Pindola, not only should you not use your psychic powers for that, but from then on he made a rule that monks must never show any psychic powers to lay people, ever. Okay? It's a confessional offense. Just because it can lead to, you know, this sort of a mess happening. Anyway, what I feel is interesting here is even when monks attain Nibbana, they can sometimes do kind of stupid things still. You know? They're still human, you know? Just because they're arahants doesn't magically cause their behavior to become perfect in every way, okay? Now, we might be tempted to believe that, well, when you're an arahant, come on, Venerable Subro, arahants are perfect, and they're perfect in every way, right? And I'm like, no, not necessarily every way, okay? They satisfy what it takes to go to Nibbana, okay? They satisfy that. That is their perfection. They attain Nibbana. But there's a lot of things they might not be perfect at, okay? They might not bake a perfect cake for you, or they might not know how to change the brake pads on your car, okay? They might not know a whole bunch of things, okay? They can't program a computer. They might have a lot of, you know, areas of knowledge they're not perfect at, including social skills. So yeah, Pindul is like very human. I really like that. Okay, I feel that the suttas need to have this kind of thing in there to reassure us that arahants still have some humanity in that way. Okay, yeah. We would hope, we would imagine that when a monk attains Nibbana, he is the perfect person now. He's the perfect leader, he's the perfect teacher, he's the perfect example, he's the perfect man, or whatever, right? We would wish that, but, you know, sometimes you just can't have all of that, you know? Yeah, to just attain Nibbana is all you are guaranteed of if you're an arahant, okay? So yeah, Pindola only had to perfect the last three out of these five indriyas. Okay, and likewise, there's a sutta where you only have to perfect the last two, believe it or not. Okay, so here's... Samyutta Nikaya 48.47, the Eastern Part. Okay, so the same setting, where I guess the Eastern Park. Sawati in the Eastern Park. Okay, the same setting. Bhikkhus, by having developed and cultivated how many faculties, does a bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declared final knowledge thus? I understand. Destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. Venerable Sir, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One. It is Bhikkhus, because he has developed... This is the one we only have to develop four. It's the last four. Energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. Okay, that's 47. Where's the one where we only have to do two? Okay, sorry, 46 I meant. Samyutta Nikaya 48.46, the Eastern Park. Okay, the same setting. Bhikkhus, same start by having developed and cultivated how many faculties? Destroyed his birth, holy life's been lived. Okay, it is Bhikkhus because he has developed and cultivated two faculties that a Bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declares final knowledge thus. What two? Noble wisdom and noble liberation. For his noble wisdom is the faculty of wisdom. His noble liberation is his faculty of concentration. It is Bhikkhus because of these two faculties. Because these two faculties have been developed and cultivated, that a Bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declares final knowledge thus. I understand. Destroyed his birth. So on and so forth, there is no more for this state of being. Okay, so even if you can develop those last two, you could be an arahant. And then in the Samyutta Nikaya 48.45, you only actually need to develop one faculty. Okay, same as the other ones. It is Bhikkhus because he has developed and cultivated one faculty that a Bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declares final knowledge thus. What is that one faculty? The faculty of wisdom. Okay, the last one. For a noble disciple who possesses wisdom, the faith that follows from it becomes stabilized. The energy that follows from it becomes stabilized. The mindfulness that follows from it becomes stabilized. The concentration that follows from it becomes stabilized. It is Bhikkhus because this one faculty has been developed and cultivated. That a Bhikkhu who has destroyed the taints declares final knowledge thus. I understand. Destroyed his birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. Okay, so I wanted to read you these few suttas where the Buddha presents this differently, you know? You need all five. Well, actually, the last four is enough. Actually, the last three is enough. Pindola Bharadvaja, you only need those last three. Actually, the last two are enough. Actually, just that last one. That one's enough. So, the point I'm trying to make to you here is this. The Buddha has many ways of presenting the Dhamma, okay? He kind of changes the formulas and lists around, you know, differently in different suttas. And how can I put this? We would be making a mistake if we were to look at the Dhamma, look at the doctrine, and expect it to be this extremely precise kind of a science, okay? It is somewhat like a science, sure. Okay, there's many patterns here to describe. There's many teachings. And I think that the Buddha did a great job of, an awesome job of, he explained the patterns when he could. Okay, whenever he could say something where there was a pattern, he did so. Okay, but the spiritual life is somewhat of an art as well. Okay, it's not just a science. It is also an art. And there is some, shall we say, there's somewhat of a flow to it. There's somewhat of a flexibility to it. Before I ordained, I went to university and I got a computer science degree. And it was extremely technical and it was extremely scientific, extremely logical. And they actually teach you all sorts of formal, you know, ways of using logic. If you've ever programmed a computer, you'll find out real fast that, you know, you better have not just good logic, but excellent logic. To get the computer to do what you want, you must very carefully tell it what you want. You cannot leave any room for error, or it will screw up in that way. So we would call that like a hard science, okay? There is nothing to do with like emotions, really. You know, there's nothing to do with, at least program a computer. There's nothing to do with like spirituality there. There's nothing to do with, you know, it's just a machine, okay? And I say the Dhamma is not like that. The Dhamma is not a hard science, okay? It's not like chemistry. You know, like in chemistry, you know, they have all these chemical formulas and you mix chemicals in certain proportions and, you know, it's totally 100% predictable the results you're going to get. As long as they do the experiments properly, the results are predictable every single time. Spirituality is different. You know, people are different. People's personalities are different. The conditioning from when they were children is different. Cultures are different. The Buddha does say that if you look at all the diversity of that you see in animals, if you look at like all the possible animals and all the diversity, there's this wide, wide diversity. You know, like small animals, big animals, every kind of animal. Actually, if you look at people's personalities, the diversity is even bigger. He says, you know, never mind the diversity of all the animals, even bigger is the diversity of people's personalities. Yeah, so there are many patterns we can speak of. You know, there are many lessons that can be taught about spirituality. But I feel it is a mistake to go too far and start treating it like it's this hard science, when it is not, okay? Yeah. People have feelings, people have histories that we, you know, probably are not aware of. People are kind of complex. What I see the Buddha doing, so I've read through the early Buddhist texts 5 times now. And I feel that I can speak in more general ways as to what is in there and what is not in there. And kind of what is the tone of it? What is the what are some of the, you know, how can we characterize it as a whole? What I see him doing is he just creates this very general structure for living the holy life, okay? That general structure is just the Vinaya, the rules of conduct for the monks and the nuns. Those are kind of like the rules of the game when you're a Buddhist monk. And ancient India, both at the time of the Buddha and today as well, they have this respect for the sadhus, respect for holy men and women. They support the sadhus with alms, food, and other kinds of support. So that was the... how can I put this? That too was part of the structure of how this whole thing worked. Just being a sadhu whatsoever. Okay, so when the Buddha came along, he didn't have to invent all these new customs like going for alms food, let's say, or wearing a robe. The sadhus were already doing that. So the Buddha just kind of showed up with a doctrine different than the other sadhus, but kind of playing that same game of being a sadhu. Okay? Anybody could be a sadhu in ancient India. It was pretty simple. But you did have to renounce the householder life, okay? You had to be celibate. And you had to have good morality. Okay, you couldn't be, let's say, a thief or, you know, violent or, you know, your morality had to be good. And then you needed some sort of a spiritual doctrine that you were going to practice. And there was quite a diversity of different doctrines at the time of the Buddha, different approaches to spirituality. So the Buddha came along and he had his own unique doctrine amongst several other possible doctrines. So what I see the Buddha doing is he creates a fairly... relaxed structure for the monks and nuns to live in. And I see him affording them quite a lot of personal liberty as long as they follow the Vinaya. The Vinaya has a lot of rules, by the way. But once you learn them, then there is some personal freedom. Different monks would train... Like, okay, the monk had several kind of chief disciples. Like, there was Sariputta, Moggallana, Ananda, Mahakasapa, etc. And depending on your personality, you could train under one of those chief disciples. So if you're really good at psychic powers, you probably want to train under Mahamoggallana. Or if you were good at samadhi, you would train under Venerable Sariputta. Or if you were good at studying and memorizing, you would train under Venerable Ananda. And if you were very ascetic, very tough, was it Mahakasapa or was it Anuruddha? Kasapa. Okay, yeah. So Mahakasapa was very tough. He was this ascetic, tough monk. So there was like a personality type who would go train with him. So I see the Buddha accommodating these different personality types. What the Buddha did not do was just try to get all the monks to exactly behave like himself. Okay? Like, you're all going to copy me exactly. You're all going to act like me exactly. You know? He allowed them to keep their original personalities. It's just that they had to follow Vinaya and do their best to attain Nibbana. There is one last sutta maybe I'll read here. It's Samyutta 48.54. You probably heard this one. It's about the elephant's footprint. This is a well-known simile. Okay, Samyutta 48.54. Bhikkhus, just as the footprints of all living beings that walk fit into the footprint of the elephant, and the elephant's footprint is declared to be their chief by reason of its size, so too, among the steps that lead to enlightenment, the faculty of wisdom is declared to be their chief. That is, for the attainment of enlightenment. And what, bhikkhus, are the steps that lead to enlightenment? The faculty of faith, bhikkhus, is a step that leads to enlightenment. The faculty of energy is a step that leads to enlightenment. The faculty of mindfulness is a step that leads to enlightenment. The faculty of concentration is a step that leads to enlightenment. The faculty of wisdom is a step that leads to enlightenment. And then he repeats, just as bhikkhus, the footprints of all living beings that walk, fit into the footprint of the elephant. And the elephant's footprint is declared to be their chief by reason of its size. So too, among the steps that lead to enlightenment, the faculty of wisdom is declared to be their chief, that is, for the attainment of enlightenment. Okay, so you probably heard that simile of the elephant's footprint, but what you may not have heard is it's in a sutta referring to the five faculties.